You're listening to the Screaming Pods Network.
Oh, no, I like Shockwaves too. I just love that. One of my favorite things about that is just a bunch of nerds who are really excited about checking out some really good movies and some real garbage at the same time. And then I told another friend of mine about Pure Cinema Podcast, and I was telling him that.
Thank you, man.
Yeah, I was just like, oh, I keep trying to like add to my list. And he goes, it's one of those, and he was telling me today, he goes, it's one of those things where I almost crashed my car because I'm trying to type into my phone another movie. Because he's like, ooh, that sounds cool. But that first one that I listened to with you, with the...
Sisters one? Were you talking about
the disc? Oh, no, but I listened to that one. That one was great. And I bought the disc because of that, too. Because I had just watched it, and I was like, oh, I just watched this. And I was like, oh, it's got a lot of cool stuff. And
yeah, dude, it's a good disc.
No, but the first Pure Cinema one, though, where you got into like, oh, and I just forgot I hadn't seen Looker since I was a kid. And I remember the whole, Looker. That's a
one of the catchiest songs.
I know.
One of the catchiest songs. That alone gets me back into it every time I watch it, but then that freeze gun, I'm like, oh, dude.
Yeah. So it gets really tricky in the third act, but Michael Crichton, even when he doesn't fully achieve what he needs to, I'm still like, he does something cool, unique every single time that's... You know, all the stuff that was on, he had that whole collection that was on Filmstruck. I don't know if you ever got that app.
I did, but I didn't see this Crichton collection.
Yeah, so they had like Coma, which would probably be on my 78 list because that's...
Nice.
And that one just really worked. It was a really interesting and dark, fucked up movie that people are just killing people to harvest their organs later on.
Yeah, I love it.
Yeah.
I almost rewatched the Blu-ray with my wife about a month ago, but we just didn't get to it.
And then at that Westworld.
Oh, I love Westworld.
Had Looker, where I was just like, "Holy shit!" My sister came. And
wait,
I,
Looker was on Filmstruck.
Looker was on Filmstruck, and that was after.
Oh,
that was
so
after.
This makes me more sad in retrospect.
I know. Fuck, man, that had so much good stuff.
The range, man.
It had like entertaining, stupid popcorn movies, and then like smarty pants movies. Like, oh, I guess I'll just get into the Kurosawa section, and I'll get into the Fassbender section. But anyway, yeah.
All right.
Okay, here we go.
All right, let me.
We'll have plenty of these departures as we go on, I'm sure.
That's totally fine. This is very conversational. We'll just open with...
Sure.
You know, whatever. I'll wing it here. got to do my dorky intro.
Mm-hmm.
So, welcome to this episode of Just the Disc. My name is Brian Sauer. This is my podcast about Blu-rays. I have an extremely special guest joining me today, and he is the creator behind such awesome things as home movies, Metalocalypse, and more... Mr. Brendan Small, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
I'm honored.
First time caller, long time listener. I've been listening to you on this. I've been listening to you on Pure Cinema Podcast, and I think I even heard you on Shockwaves before.
I did do one Shockwaves, yes.
But you're a man after my own heart. You like movies. So do I.
I do.
Yeah.
I was really psyched to hear you on Shockwaves myself.
Oh, that was fun. I really enjoyed being around. I just want to... Something happens with podcasts, too, where... You just get used to them. It becomes a part of your life. So they become your family, whether or not they know it.
It's a very intimate thing. Elric and I have talked about this. And I have it with people, shows that I listen to.
Yeah.
But it's a weird thing because the people that then you meet, they don't understand that.
They don't know, yeah.
Right?
They don't know. But people do that with me sometimes
with
my voice.
I was going to say.
So I'm sure we're kind of maybe cross-sectioning in different ways. But I'm happy to be here either way. And I'm happy to have been covering the subject matter that we're covering on this day.
Yes, we are going to talk about a little movie called Candyman.
That's right.
Do I know you?
No. No. But you doubted me.
I'm sorry, I have to go.
No need to leave yet.
But I'm late.
You are not content with the stories, so I was obliged to come. Be my victim. Be my victim. I am the writing on the wall, the whisper in the classroom. Without these things, I am nothing. So now I must shed innocent blood. Come with me.
I gave you a short list, a very short list of movies to choose from that I was looking to cover.
Yes.
And you picked Candyman, and I'm curious why, not that I have any issue with Candyman,
but of course not.
Why did you pick Candyman?
Well, I love Sammy Davis Jr. Who can make the sunshine?
Yeah, that's...
Sprinkle it with dew.
great musical number, I forgot.
Great, yeah. They didn't really put that in the movie.
I think it's an outtake.
They never talked about it in the Blu-ray. But I'm a fan of this movie. I remember the first time I saw it. I just remember some visual things, really. And I remember the story, of course. And I remember Virginia Madsen and everybody. But this movie was just on my mind. And I wanted to look at it again, and I hadn't, and I saw that this was coming out maybe like 9 months ago or something. The people at Shout Factory were putting this out, or Scream Factory, and I just kept on holding out and holding out and holding out, and then finally I just, it came out, and I had it ordered already. So when That's you tight. Gave me that list, I already had it ordered, and I was like, let's do this, because I just want to do a deep dive in this movie, because kind of fascinated, and there's a lot. I haven't seen it in a long time. It had been years since I'd seen it.
Same here for me. And I had kind of, outside of the iconic Tony Todd performance.
Yeah.
I remembered Virginia Madsen, but I didn't remember a lot of the other stuff. I didn't remember Xander Berkeley, who's always a scumbag.
Right. Yeah.
And I didn't remember like kind of some of her thesis stuff. Like, I mean, the basic plot is she's a professor, I guess.
Yeah. She's like working on some kind of a thesis project, and it's. And this is another thing I like about it, is that it's self-reflexive, and this kind of, it's a monster movie about monsters, about legendary monsters or whatever. And so she is doing research on this made-up character inside of this world. And then her friend, I forgot, I was like, is this girl, I just kind of remember her as being the same girl as the girl from Silence of the Lambs, and it was Casey Lemons.
Oh, I didn't even realize
that. It's the same girl, and she's great, and the two of them are great. And then I just remember this movie, comparatively to a lot of movies that were happening that were about some kind of cool, ghoulish, nightmarish creatures, from like Freddy Krueger to Jason to Mike Myers and stuff, this guy stood out. And this movie, to me, always felt like it was done... Like, a guy just really, he wanted to make this a really good movie. And I think that between him and Clive Barker, Bernard, I think it was just a lot of smart people in the room who wanted to do something. It was kind of grandiose. It was big in scale. I remember those helicopter shots.
Those are great.
And I remember, like, I thought, whoa, these are so smooth. And I remember seeing, like, a commentary or, like, a behind the scenes in Zodiac, the Blu-ray, where Fincher fabricated these like basically helicopter shots,
but they wouldn't be smooth enough, so he made it so they would.
He made it so it took like a hard right angle that was like perfect. It was like a perfect rail shot, like it was on rails, and I thought, this is so perfect because it's following these highways and it's just geometric and interesting, and we're establishing basically Chicago. And I just remember, this movie has cool scale, it's got these great helicopter shots, which now they would probably do with a drone and they wouldn't be as, you know, but back then there weren't that many.
Well, and also Bernard said something in the commentary about how they don't usually mount the cameras, I think, directly under the helicopter.
Right.
Well, we only shot in Chicago for a week. We did, but most of the exteriors are actually done in Chicago. Obviously, the helicopter stuff, which was actually some really nice chopper flying over downtown Chicago, which involved us rigging the camera directly looking down, which hadn't been done before that film. We actually got them to really change the helicopter mount to do it.
And which gave it that great, perfect overhead, almost looks like a model kind of look.
Yeah.
It really sets the tone. And then you've got the Philip Glass score, right?
You got Philip Glass, yeah. So you got Philip Glass. Oh, I can do a little.
Do some Philip Glass.
This is something I...
This is live, folks.
So what, it goes into something else, but it's basically... like the big ending chorale. I'm trying to do this with one hand.
It's impressive.
And then he goes, and it just keeps on, the bass keeps changing. So if you go to like, there you go, that's the thing. And then it goes down to the five. So it goes in this thing. And it sounds like the Room really liberally ripped that off, the movie The Room, with
the little diddle-diddle.
Oh, wow.
And
it's just this 1/5, boom.
That's funny, man.
Anyway, it's 1/4.
I love the idea that Tommy Wiseau was a big Philip Glass fan.
Yeah, well, you know, there are only like 4 themes, I think, for the most part in this thing. Maybe there are more, but these are the ones that I just picked up because in my screening room, my living room, I have a piano, an upright piano. So if a song gets stuck in my head, I usually go over to that and I just try to figure out what the score is. I told you I did it with Looker. I figured it out.
That is awesome,
which
by the way.
Yeah.
Let's do some Looker.
She's a look. That's what I'm down.
Too
She's
much
a look
fun.
Good. So yeah,
that's too much fun right there.
Anyway, yeah,
yeah, but no, that score is—it's so simple, and I think part of it is there's a whole thing with the score. Not that we need to get too far into it, but he, you know, they talked him into doing it. He gave them like some pieces,
yes,
and then they started editing with those, and then he reorchestrated. But ultimately, he didn't. It doesn't sound like he did a full score.
Yeah, it seems like he gave him like a bunch of tracks, and you can see like every time they cut to a huge establishing shot or like a big wide shot, there's a straight down shot of these circular steps that they keep coming back to.
Oh, yeah.
And you just hear at that, you know, every time that happens, you just hear like some kind of like. So you hear like some big gothic chords and it just makes the world seem big.
Yeah.
It makes the whole thing sound like a big crazy church. And they talk about that too, is making the projects, the Cabrini Green projects and basically the penthouse apartment that's abandoned, this kind of strange, almost gothic like church. But anyway, so the scale was something that I really remembered. And then I just remember Virginia Madsen. I just like looking at her a lot. She's
a pretty good looking lady. I'm a big Modern Girls fan. I don't know if you're a big fan of that movie, if you've seen that one.
Between night and day.
Why don't you stop looking so hard?
Between now and tomorrow, Margot, Cece, Kelly, and Cliff will find what they are looking for.
Who are you people?
I will if you will.
And something they never imagined. In each other.
I don't know that one as much, but I thought about, I gotta rewatch Electric Dreams, I guess.
Oh, dude.
I haven't watched that since I rented it in like the 80s.
I have an import Blu-ray of Electric Dreams, and I'm sure you have the vinyl too.
I don't have the vinyl for that, but I remember it's like
Jeff Lynne stuff, man.
Oh, is that Jeff Lynne?
Yeah, man.
Oh, geez, that's how long it's been. I love Jeff Lynne, so.
I figured you're a fan.
Wow. Okay, that's cool.
Yeah, it's
I
good.
Didn't know that, so it's I gotta good. Track that. So what, you know, I can only get that if I have a multi-region Blu-ray player, is that what you're telling me?
Maybe. That's one that it's kind of ridiculous because that movie should have a domestic release. Not to get too tangential about Electric Dreams.
Oh, it's okay. Hey, it's okay with me, Matt. This is your podcast.
No, but this is a Blu-ray, and I want Shout Select to pick it up. Somebody.
Well, I'll tell you this. I've been working with Shout Factory for like 15 plus years because they put out the original home movies, DVDs, and I remember. When I found out they were doing it, they had a library at the time that I was like, this is so well curated. There's so many cool movies that they're kind of off the beaten path. Plus, you know, old cool TV, like You Bet Your Life, old Groucho Marx and stuff like
that.
Right. And like the Jack Parr Show and things like that. So nerdy comedy gold, you know. And then they had really cool documentaries and I was really excited about those. And some are out of print, but some of them were really important to me. But they started getting into the horror thing. And I was like, yes. Please. So every time I think of a movie that I can't find anywhere, I directly contact them and I go, please, I implore you, ladies and gentlemen.
That's good, man.
So I don't know if they'll listen or if they're going to find out, but I don't know if they're going to, you know, if I'm sure they have to weigh it against, like, will this make money? Is there a big enough audience?
Yeah. How much does it cost to get the rights?
I will tell them about Electric Dreams. And then they have cool stuff and, like, stuff that's been out of print for a long time, like, just like a really cool anime movie, Electric Blue. Is it? Well, no.
Perfect Blue. Yeah,
sorry,
that's coming out. Yeah.
Yeah. And I haven't seen that in a long time. I've just been wanting to look at that again. So anyway.
Yeah, they're doing all kinds. It's a really great company. I mean, not to just get all Shout Factory'd out, but I mean, between the Shout Factory Select imprint, which put out two of my all-time favorite movies last year. They put out 3 o'clock High and they put out Into the Night.
Yeah, okay.
I love both those movies. So you've already got my heart with that. But they're just clearly doing a lot of cool stuff. And obviously Scream Factory is killing it.
Without a doubt,
And this disc we were talking about before we started, I know there's an Arrow version of this, and I haven't done a Pepsi challenge with two, but I believe a lot of it is the same stuff.
It could, okay.
But yeah, I mean, I don't know. We don't have to talk about the extras just yet. I mean, so...
Sure.
So I think for me, the thing that stood out this time, you were talking about the gothicness of it. That definitely hit me, obviously, right away.
Yeah.
But then I started to notice, like, Dracula vibes way more.
Without a doubt,
that I didn't catch the first time I watched it.
Well, it's Dracula, and then at some point somebody goes, what do you think, I'm Frankenstein? And I go, oh, yeah, it's Frankenstein, too. So it's Dracula and Frankenstein. So this is a great study on... And this is why I love this movie, because I'm sure they could go on and... remake Frankenstein, remake Dracula, and in fact, I think later on, Bernard Rose did do a version of Frankenstein. but what they did was they took the short story by Clive Barker, and they fleshed it out, and they took it to a place that both of them wouldn't have come to on their own, which I love. It's the ultimate collaboration where two people are really making each other better, and they created a new folklore. And a new thing based on, Bloody Mary and all these other kind of cool ghosts that you can summon and then they kill you. but I think this is what filmmakers should do, is they should get inspired by Count Dracula and Frankenstein and all these cool monsters and make their own version.
Absolutely.
I think that there's something seductive in that gothic way about a phantom like Candyman. The side of us that wishes that Dracula could run off with his lady friend and that he would sort of climb into your window one night and, you would willingly become his partner throughout eternity. The fact that we love Frankenstein, we understand he's a monster, but we pity him and we want him to be okay and we're sad when he falls into the sulfur pit at the end of the story. Candyman is really ultimately good. That's, he was a good man that was done wrong, and he became evil through no fault of his own. That's the same with Dracula and Frankenstein, and even the werewolf. I mean, it wasn't his fault. He was bit, and so he kills and he ravages, but it's not his fault.
Absolutely.
And that's why this movie is a really cool movie to me. Plus, it's an artistic movie. It's a big movie, I think, especially in this genre. And then I think it's just handled intelligently. And so that stuff. And I remember it, it was like 3 or 4 years or no, maybe not even that after Silence of the Lambs.
I want to say this is 92, so it's just a couple years maybe at the most, maybe just a year.
They don't really talk about it too much in the commentaries. Only once did they bring it up, but I thought this is a direct, distant cousin of that movie. I feel like since that movie was so grounded and dramatic, and gothic too, that I feel like this movie did live in the shadow of that movie in a great way, where now I can see it. Kind of.
Yeah, so. Totally. I can see that too. Yeah, there's just something about that Tony Todd performance and they talked about Phantom of the Opera, yet another Universal monster that's in there and all that stuff. It totally got me more this time. And it's still a genuinely scary movie, which is pretty interesting considering how old it is.
Exactly. And it's not just there are great scares and jumps where he just shows up out of nowhere. But it's really interesting because Virginia Madsen plays it in a way that she's not terrified. She's literally hypnotized, as we find out.
We got to bring it up.
But she is, hypnotized. And so, yeah.
Yeah, they talk about it in the commentary too, and in a couple of the interviews, that there were moments where somehow Bernard Rose talked her into getting hypnotized to be, quote-unquote, under the spell of Candyman. And so she is literally hypnotized in some of those scenes.
Yeah, they hypnotized her.
Which is crazy.
I had a psychic one time told me never be hypnotized because your subconscious will open and all kinds of dark things will fly in. She was right. It just put me into this really intense state of relaxation. And my eyes would get really glassy. My pupils would dilate. So I was not faking it. I mean, he was really able to put me into this trance. And as the film went on, sometimes we would do it not just for a Candyman scene, but, I think we did it for a couple of other scenes. Where he just wanted to have that kind of look in my eyes. So eventually he was able to do it very quickly. In the beginning, it would take about you know, 10 or 15 minutes sitting on the corner of the set somewhere, and we were really careful, and I'd be let in, and the crew was really quiet, and they were like, I mean, the crew was very tolerant of us. But then, when they started to see the way I looked, they were like, okay, this is really going on here. And then he was able to do it pretty much, we didn't have to go someplace special, he was able to pretty much do it on the set over in a corner, because once he would start hypnotizing me, I couldn't hear anything else. It would almost sound like I was listening to a seashell, and pretty much the only thing I could hear was Bernard's voice. And as this is going on, in my mind, I'm like, I can't believe I'm doing this. This is the silliest thing I've ever done for a movie. And but yet it was happening, because you're cognizant, you're aware, you're not asleep. So I was like watching myself do this, like I was fascinated.
So okay, so when I first put this back on for the first time in a long time, first of all, I just noticed the print looked really great, the music was really loud, and his voiceover, the processing they do, because you can tell they ADR'd his voice, and it's just super close mic, and it's just coming out of every single speaker, and it's resounding and low and cool sounding, and he has this little soliloquy that he says at the very top of the movie, and I'm just like, ooh, my couch is rumbling with his voice.
It's a great soliloquy.
They will say that I have shed innocent blood. What's blood for, if not for shedding? With my hook for a hand, I'll split you from your groin to your gullet.
But it's
great. It really sets things up for him. And there's a really interesting notion that you can look at the movie as something where he doesn't exist and it's just her descending madness, which I think is bullshit personally. But they
worked hard to make sure that both of those iterations kind of do function.
Absolutely.
But the movie's telling us a movie. I mean, it better be Candyman.
Yeah, it's as far fun, as I'm concerned.
It's almost like, you know, when I Wizard of Oz, she better have gone to Oz. I'm not going to be happy if she didn't go to goddamn Oz. All this, it took her. I watched all that shit and Toto and there's a Tin Man and I believed them all and I fell in love and it didn't happen. Fuck you.
Exactly. No, I agree. All a dream didn't happen. Rarely do I let that pass. But anyway, it's interesting.
But it's a fantastic writing exercise because you do want to have both sides of that argument. Does Candyman here, or is this a story about a woman in a loveless marriage who loses her goddamn mind and starts killing people? But they make both of those stories plausible, and I think that makes it a really good script.
Yeah, and the urban legendness of it really makes it iconic. To the point where there's a great bit, and again, in the commentary where Clive Barker was talking about...
When I started writing about the Candyman, or thought I might write about the Candyman, it wasn't with a conscious sense of, oh, wow, I'm going to be telling an urban legend at all. I don't think I would have even known the term urban legend when I wrote the story, which makes it doubly funny that since then there have been... deconstructions of the story, academic deconstructions of the story, which are very much about how much reading I must have done and how much I must have known. And, you know, this author knew nothing. It all comes from sitting at grandma's knee while she tells you a story about not going into public toilets. This amuses me a little bit, but I know there are a number of very learned pieces that have been written now about the Candyman and the tradition of the Candyman, and in a number of pieces written by academics, I am taken to task for so nakedly stealing from the Black American tradition the mythology of the Candyman, which of course I invented the mythology of the Candyman. And she had to write to one of these professors in Chicago, actually, and say, you know, I can't take this, you know. Here's the history of the Candyman. I invented this guy, you know. And she said, I thought it was all an urban legend. And it was just one that I hadn't read about. And I said, no, wrong.
Right.
But it's so effective that you kind of think it is.
So that's an interesting point, because in the book, Candyman, first of all, is it even Candyman in the book? Because I didn't read the short story. I have it now on my Kindle, so I will be reading it.
Nice, impressive.
But
I can't remember if he is.
I don't even know if he's African-American, you know?
Oh, yeah, I don't know.
So, I mean, first of all, it's supposed to take place in Liverpool or something like that.
Yep.
And some old abandoned place. And then I think Bernard Rose was the one that said, let's make it a slave who bought his way out, or is, you know, and let's create this kind of demonic black guy character.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And it's funny because, you know, you've got a British director and a British writer, you know, and well, I guess Clive Barker's British too.
Yeah.
And it's their take on Chicago and the inner city and the projects and what they considered in the commentary to be this new haunted house.
Yeah.
The project. So with that probably comes a great deal of scrutiny.
Yeah.
Just the fact that you're attacking that.
Understandably, yeah. And because it feels like the kind of story you hear passed down, it feels like something that, like, because of the Bloody Mary thing, which that's another, as I understand it, it's another thing that Bernard Rose added was the looking in the mirror and conjuring. I don't think that was in the
Bloody Mary thing.
I think he added that for this, but I'm not sure.
As a kid, I heard about Bloody Mary before Candyman happened.
Right?
So I knew about what Bloody Mary was, and I think there was a mirror involved, at least in the version that I...
In the Bloody Mary, right?
Yeah, in Bloody Mary. You say,
yeah, but what I'm saying is that I don't think Candyman originally had that aspect in the story.
Correct. It didn't. Yes, it didn't. Okay, so Bernard, yeah, he definitely.
Which is, I mean, that's essential. I love that.
Yes.
That the use of the mirror. Mirrors in general are a great device for horror films.
Yeah.
And just as a portal, as this, you know, sort of looking potentially into another dimension. There's all kinds of things you can look at mirrors for, but just this idea of conjuring because of it, through it, I think the movie is not the same without that little device, you know?
I like it. And it also adds up in the Clive Barker world because it's the box from Hellraiser 2 because you are conjuring up a bunch of Cenobites, which is a tricky thing to do because you're supposed to, I guess you're supposed to be experiencing all this sexual pleasure, which is a hard thing to film, you know, like a guy going, hey, this is nice, you know what I mean? And then all of a sudden hooks go in your flesh and now the pain.
I just go to sleeper immediately. I'm just like, the orgasmatron is the only which is just ridiculous looking.
Well, they played that a little more out in the open. They're smirking and they're just like,
hey.
Yeah, exactly.
But so I was surprised how well it held up. I mean, I remembered it being pretty great, and I remembered Elric also saying, like, one of the best horror films of the 90s. And
yeah,
I was like,
without a doubt.
It definitely is.
So the other thing that struck me at the very top when I first, once you get past the opening credits, is you hear this girl who we don't see other than the very beginning, and you just hear her voice telling the story.
That's right.
And she tells one of the perfect, like, folklore stories of a guy who ends up being Ted Raimi. Which is hilarious because he's supposed to be, like,
a
handsome greaser kind of guy. And he's supposed to be a dangerous bad boy, right? And they tell the story and, you know, and they go through the whole thing. And we cut back to the girl and she's telling the story of Virginia Madsen. And that's when we meet our hero. And what I was immediately struck by was how relaxed the acting was. It wasn't too presentational. It was conversational.
Yeah.
And then I saw Virginia Madsen. And I saw her and Casey Lemons acting. And I was just watching the acting for a while. And I was going, wait a minute. This is actually, an actor's director, is what I thought the very first time. I was like, we've got really, really cool visuals already. We've got these bees. We're floating into like just a swarm of bees up close. And then we have this huge panoramic shot of Chicago with all these bees everywhere.
Yeah.
And then I realized, oh, this guy, inside of all this stuff, really cares about every single performance. And he did a lot of things to get these performers up and running.
Yeah, the hypnotism and what have you.
Well, hypnotism, but also having them hang out together.
Yeah.
And then he also said, one other thing that struck me in the commentaries was he said, Virginia Madsen's too beautiful.
Oh, yeah.
I don't see her this beautiful. I see her, and he started encouraging her to, he started bringing her pizza all the time. Let's get Virginia Madsen real fat.
And don't make her up.
Make her up, except for a couple shots and she's hypnotized and she has this great noir style.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, like vignetted kind of eyes. And it's really, I just thought this is a movie that people really, really gave a shit about. And you can hear in the commentary tracks with the actors, with everybody else, they have an affection for this movie too. When Virginia Madsen talks about it, I don't know if she'd talk about Dune the same way. I would hope that she would, because I love Dune. But
I don't think so. I think this is a really big, like, she obviously put a lot into this, really put herself out there. I mean, between the hypnotism, the stuff that she did with the bees, including one scene talks about got cut that sounded amazing with like 3,000 bees on her face.
I was hoping that scene would show up in the director's cut.
Yeah.
I didn't see it.
I didn't either. And maybe it's in the outtakes and I might have missed it, but it wasn't.
Oh, the footage is
what
lost.
A bummer.
I know. Well, that's another thing. You bring up the idea that this is a totally practical effect movie. So from top to bottom, even if they're like, well, they'll composite some stuff. Like in the very beginning, they have to have this swarm of bees over, you know, the landscape of Chicago, the skyline of Chicago. And you know that that's a compositing thing, but that's still practical. There's no CG. This is kind of pre-CGI. This is like pre-Jurassic Park, right? So So not everybody had leapt onto the CGI world, and they didn't need to. And this movie really is all practical, and you've got some cool gore effects. And you've also got real bees, which I don't think they would let anyone do these days.
Probably not. Why would they? I mean, no. They could just CG that stuff. But
yeah, but they really had, at some point they talk about, because Tony Todd has a mouthful of bees at one point.
That's just insane to me.
And he had some kind of a mouth condom. They called it a mouth condom.
Yeah.
And he's got live bees walking around his mouth.
It's
hanging
insane.
Out.
And then
flying
you see something
out.
About how they got behind the condom in his throat. Gnarly. It's just gnarly. I mean, he seems sort of at peace with the idea that this is his legacy, this movie, this character.
Well, and why shouldn't he be?
Absolutely.
You know?
No, yeah. I mean, I could see, I think for one reason that I was surprised is he seems like incredibly articulate, incredibly intelligent.
Yeah.
Not that I wouldn't expect that from him.
Sure.
But sometimes when you see a certain character, you're like, well, I don't know what to expect from this actor. And
exactly.
He is so, so smart and so put together that I could see a person like that maybe tiring of this one thing or being known for this, but he's just a very zen dude, it feels like.
I think at this point he knows he brought it,
yeah,
you know? And I think that's a tricky thing to do, to be, again, it's sexy, cool, relaxed Count Dracula. It's
yep.
not a person kind of like, you know, steepling their fingers and going, I'm evil. It's this guy who's got a look about him, too, that's woeful. You know, he's sad. The first time we really see a good look at him, he almost looks like he's crying. He looks like he's unhappy. And that's a great monster.
Yeah.
You know, that's what Count Dracula, it's not his fault he's Count Dracula. It's not Frankenstein's fault he's Frankenstein, the monster. Frankenstein's monster. Before you get online.
Nerds.
You nerds. God damn you. But that's the greatest. I was even thinking about these woeful creatures. And I love this. I love the woeful monster, the put upon victim, you know. I was even thinking about Roberts, and I may be the only guy that has an affection for this movie, but Robert Zemeckis' Beowulf, Crispin Glover's portrayal of Grendel.
Yeah, I haven't seen this in a long time.
Oh, he's like, it's got he's that sad. He's
melancholy.
He's got melancholy to him.
Oh,
and it's
wow.
And I just, I mean, it is a crucial part of a great villain. And as you listen to people talk, and I forgot who said this, but they said, you do this two, three times, it stops being a villain and starts becoming a comedian.
Oh, yeah.
And they said that about, and I was like, oh, yeah, Freddy Krueger kind of became a comedian. Like,
that's Freddy's... my biggest problem with those movies is that I guess two and three are the last two that I don't dislike the other ones, but the first iteration of him is so
He's chilling,
yeah,
but he's
chilling,
also
exactly.
He's also a wise ass kind of.
Yeah.
He's almost Bugs Bunny-esque, you know?
Yeah.
But it gets sillier, and you get into like Freddy's Nightmares, the TV show from like the early 90s. I logged a lot of hours of that show.
And I get it. I totally do. But for some reason, I much prefer the Candyman type, just really, you know.
Powerful. And the second one, I don't know. I mean,
I haven't seen the second one.
Oh, so that one's.
Tell me about it.
I watched that one recently. I was just in Louisiana, and I was like, okay, I need some Louisiana movies. And I had. Let's see, what do we got? Angel Heart, we got The Big Easy, what's another New Orleans movie? I was like, oh, the end of Easy Rider, okay. So I kind of went, and this is when I travel, I really like to go and check out locations.
That's the thing that you do? Like,
when I travel.
Oh, to look at the locations?
Yeah, I don't travel to do this, but while I'm there, I may as well go and see where, like, I did, I have on my Instagram, you can see that I'm joking, but I'm not joking, but I went to a lot of locations in Florence where Hannibal shot.
Nice.
Hannibal, the, you know, the unceremonious, you know. Kind of sequel, which I fucking love. I don't care. It's a great gore movie. Yeah.
Another one that I've not seen, stupidly, because I just...
It falls in a category. I'm sure you've got some kind of podcast about this, where the sequel's nowhere near the first one, but it's totally entertaining. And it's not... The story will not work as well, but I love a lot of it. So there are a lot of movies like this. So Candyman 2, Farewell to the Flesh, I think does kind of function on its own steam, and I think it's a well-made movie. But, you know... Silence of the Lambs, which I think is a masterpiece, to Hannibal. Hannibal is a gore splatter film, which I fucking love. And I love every part about it. I love that it's shot in Italy. I love Gary Oldman in this movie. I love the makeup effects. I love all this stuff. And I think the story functions on its own, and it's still silly. Poltergeist 2 is never going to be Poltergeist, which is one of my favorite movies.
But Poltergeist 3, though.
Poltergeist 3 is insane.
I love that movie.
That movie's insane.
I agree.
Poltergeist 2, there's still stuff. I would not throw the baby out with the bathwater. I still think it's interesting. I still think they advanced to a different level, but it's nowhere going to be as good. And I think there are a million movies like this.
Right.
We'll never achieve the first movie. And people hate them, and I love them.
No, I think it's unfair. And I think that it's all about expectations, which with movies is one of the worst things in the world. And I think it's only gotten worse now because we have so much marketing, so much hype machine around everything,
right,
that you really, you don't have as much of an opportunity to sort of fine tune your expectations.
Right.
Unless you just try and tune all that
out.
Or
they just, I mean, I just went to a movie where they showed, and it felt like a 4.5 minute scene from Aquaman from, and I'm like, shouldn't we get on with a real movie? I mean, what are we doing here? And they're like, look, you know what you're getting now. You've seen most of it.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's really where what it's come to is that they, I guess, feel like they need to show you a lot to sell you.
Maybe.
And the art of the tease, which is one of my favorite things, a good teaser, has always been my favorite kind of marketing. And so, anyway.
And I think we have had some of those recently. But
totally.
We don't,
no.
But we don't, we can get, we
don't, we don't have to go there.
I can do it if you want to. You tell me.
No, it's fine. It's fine. But what I'm saying is that expectations tend to really fuck things up for movies all the time. So when you got sequels, you've got a known quantity and you're trying to carry some quasi, like, I kind of want that thing that I saw, but I kind of want it to be different.
Yeah.
And then you're like, oh, but it wasn't what I want, you know, the thing from before. And then you're like, well, but I shouldn't just, you know. So it's this whole conflictual thing.
We're bringing it back to Candyman.
Yes.
Candyman 2, Farewell to the Flesh, does have, it kind of expounds on the original story a little bit. But they kind of also do this thing that I think the first Candyman does, which is another Dracula thing where there is this trope that happens in some movies. And this is this romantic trope of the woeful put upon villain where he's in love with a girl or he has some connection to a girl and he sees the reincarnation of the girl later on. And that's like Mina from Dracula from the original novel, you know? And he kind of has that in this too, with Virginia Madsen, where you see like paintings of her. Like, this has always been in the stars.
Kind
this had to happen.
The Shining or whatever the hell kind
it
of
was
like,
always you is
exactly.
what he says.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah, exactly. The Shining. You've always been here too. Yeah. So that's an interesting thing that they do in this too.
But yeah, which is another thing I totally forgot about, by the way.
Yeah.
That it was that sort of maybe reincarnation, maybe some kind of cosmic.
I love it too, where they don't really shine too much of a light on it. And they drift at the very end of this movie. They're drifting in to this gothic painting in this, again, this decrepit church. And then they have this, that big, you know, kind of chorale playing underneath it. So you're like, oh, I think I just experienced something wonderful. And that's the great thing that music can do to a movie too. And a good drift into a cool gothic painting.
Yeah. No, it's
all movies should end that way.
I agree. And it's too bad that Philip Glass, I think, was a little embarrassed about it and what have you. Because I think it's one of the great pieces of music he's ever done.
Yeah, it's...
And he's done a lot of great music.
Without a doubt. And this is... And someone else said this, and I tend to agree, that it's not like his normal stuff. Because he does this like on this long kind of like rinse and repeat.
The circular...
Slow morphing kind of pieces, you know, with like the Kronos Quartet and all this stuff.
Yeah.
But this one... So the thing that confused me about this at first was that I think you're right what you said is I think he wrote some stuff. I think he may have seen a couple of things, but he didn't know he was doing a horror film. And after he went to the premiere, he's like, you made me do a horror film. And I go, what is this weirdo? Didn't know what kind of a movie? Did he not ask any questions whatsoever? Look, you're Philip Glass. You're a professional. You have to ask these questions.
Well, I mean, like, how did he come up with something based on what? Based on, I'm just wondering
it
if.
It could have been a script. Yeah, exactly. He had to have seen something.
Yeah, something that would have at some point indicated that it was horror. But regardless.
And we were talking about this right before. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say the I had recently happened upon a movie just because Dario Argento had produced it was a movie called The Church, which is an Italian movie by who directed it? It was
Michele Suovi. I can't say.
Yeah, it's the guy who was he's the lead and he also directs and he also acts in other. I think he's in Demons also and he anyway.
Yeah.
But I remember watching this movie at the end. I was like, this is really good music. And this is a few years before, but it was also by Philip Glass. So
this is
a horror film. And that was like a gory horror film.
Yeah, if you're going to be ashamed of something, I'm not saying you should be ashamed of any movie, but definitely not a horror movie. But more of that than this, especially because Bernard Rose makes a point of saying that the music is used to set the mood, not for gore or terror scenes, but for sort of things in between, you know?
Yeah, so and it really does help. That kind of stuff really does. There's a wonderful thing that music can do, which is make something that is very small, because this is kind of a chamber drama with like four characters, really, you know, with big locations. Like I said, the one of my favorite things about this movie is when we are in the actual real Cabrini Green, which is this project, the camera knows to go like, oh, there's the Johnny Hancock building. So that's Chicago. We're here. And it's doing some really good landing of location and grounding the movie in a huge atmosphere. But it's not that big. A lot of these indoor scenes are that. Some of those are on set somewhere else here in L.A. And That music, though, that big gothic choir makes the movie even bigger.
Absolutely.
And that's a crucial thing. I think that's a really important thing, is the music really can make something feel bigger than it is.
Yeah, and I think we talked about the opening shots already, but there is something to be said for... this plays into the Dracula thing a little bit for me. I was like thinking about, this is probably a reach, but sort of a soaring over the city. You know, sort of a bat soaring over the city, gothic music playing. It gives this sense of omnipotence, this sense of, you know, a malevolent force that's just floating above everything.
Yeah.
Again, I'm reaching, but I feel like you start with that,
Then I
feel like even if you get intimate and you're only dealing with four characters, you've already started way above and just sort of set.
But
set
I think that's another just important part of horror movie making: is start foreboding, establish that bad things are coming, and then go to status quo. You know, go to like, okay, here we are. This is my work. I'm listening to this interview, smoking a cigarette. I'm going, well, this is crazy bullshit. I talk to my friend, and we go, and we don't take any of it seriously. And then she walks into. It was so great, and this is where I also thought it was really good. I guess you'd call it just actors inhabiting their bodies really well. When she goes and she finds her husband teaching a big class, and she's kind of Colosseum seating kind of
lecture hall.
Lecture hall, exactly. Yeah. And she sees him, and from far away, she sees that a girl is kind of flirting with her husband, and he's kind of flirting back with her. And when she walks into so then there's another shot. It's kind of a wider shot where Virginia Madsen walks over to her husband, and he backs away just perfectly, like he probably would have. There was just really good understanding physical acting going on. There's another thing that doesn't always happen.
I watched that intro scene twice, and not to spoil anything, but there's certain things that are revealed later that you can kind of get a sense of in that scene. And there's a lot about the physicality of those two characters and another character. And just seeing that again, I'm like, wow, it's just so obvious. It's just so heavy-handed. And you kind of get it the first time. But I was just like, that's a neat thing. That's a neat thing that actors and director can do, set up this subconscious thing. You know?
And you just, I mean, I think it's just getting into the small details and playing. And also, that's why I thought, this guy's an actor's director. And I don't always see that in horror.
No, you don't. You definitely don't. A lot of horror stuff ends up being maybe a slightly more technically inclined director, because you're dealing with either tricky shots or gore effects or things that might take more of the director's focus and attention away from actors.
Yeah.
So it is a kind of nice thing to have. And it's neat that this movie ends up being one of the better horror movies of this period.
Yes. I think it's earned. I think there's a lot of really good brains working together
on
this movie. Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, let's dig into the extras here, which there are plenty. So you've got...
there are a lot of extras.
I think you actually went through more of this than I did, but...
I took my appearance here very seriously.
I do. And, I'm truly touched.
I've never been in a situation or something where I forced it upon myself. I must watch every single...
Not even I do that, so I really appreciate that you did. But yeah, so you've got basically you got two discs here. You've got on disc one, you've got the theatrical cut of the film. On disc two, you have the unrated cut. Both seem to be new 2K restorations from a 4K scan of an original negative, supervised by director Bernard Rose and the director of photography on the theatrical. That's not listed on the unrated, however, which is interesting. But then you have a shit ton of commentaries on the theatrical cut.
Oh boy, yeah, you've got a lot.
So you start with one that I know is ported over from a DVD, and that's a good commentary. It's, that's not the first one, but it's got, let's see here.
So the first one is the Bernard Rose and Tony Todd. That's the new one. Okay.
I think that's new, yeah. So yeah, that's good too. But they're talking about, I feel like they started talking about like present day movies. Like they were talking about...
They were talking about a lot of stuff that was very present day. They were talking about politics that was present day. Yes, so it felt like it was like this fall.
Yeah,
or, you know.
That was just recorded. But it was neat the way that they have a good rapport together. They obviously have a good relationship still. So that one's solid. Then you've got one of my favorite guys ever in Kim Newman, with this guy, Stephen Jones, which it's more of a sort of an academic / fan, but those guys really know what they're talking about. Kim Newman's like an experienced horror writer.
Right.
And a super nerdy, awesome dude.
And they've known Clive since the old days.
That's right.
You know? And that's an interesting thing. You just to remember who Clive is and how Clive is an anomaly. He's this really interesting, dark, and out of the closet. He's not just a novelist. He's a filmmaker, and he's a director, and he's all this stuff. But there wasn't a lot of that going on at the time, especially doing stuff that was like this much horror, you know?
There still isn't. I mean, I still don't think there's somebody that dabbles in so many different forms of art. I mean, he does paintings and stuff. And
he's like a... I'm always inspired by guys like that do more than one thing, you know?
Yeah, you're kind of one of those guys yourself.
So I get bored easily, so I like to do more than one
thing.
That's good.
So that's really good. And Kim Newman always has really interesting insights. And it's just one of those guys you can tell, you can just set him down mm-hmm. and be like, Candyman, go. And he just goes.
Yeah. 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 Very much. That was it. I just listened to that one today.
I like that. Yeah. I like him a lot. Whenever I see him on a track, I always appreciate it. So then the old audio commentary, the one I was thinking of at the beginning, has Bernard Rose, Clive Barker, producer Alan Poole, actors Tony Todd, Virginia Madsen, and Casey Lemons.
Yeah.
And that's a really great track.
I think so, too. I love a well-curated track that's thoughtful, and you know that some work went into just arranging that, you know?
Because they do the thing which doesn't happen in a lot of commentaries where they actually have everybody introduce themselves, and then they give them sort of an audio lower third
yes.
at the beginning of yes. some of their stuff. So you're like, oh, who's right. that again? And then they, Clive Barker, you know?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It can get annoying, but actually it's really helpful, I think, just to kind of keep track of when you have five or six people on a track.
Without a doubt.
It's really yeah, neat. It almost never happens now.
Yeah, I think it is important for people to slate their names all the time, because some people, except for Clive Barker, who has a voice that he sounds like down here. He's down there. He's got a voice that's a little chewed up, and it makes him sound like, oh, this guy should be making horror movies.
Absolutely.
Clive Barker. Bernard liked this metafiction idea. He liked the idea that it was going to be a movie about horror movies. It's going to be a monster movie about monsters. And one of the great things about Bernard is he isn't shy about his enthusiasms. And it became very clear to me, and I'm not either, and it became very clear to me that we were going to have fun. We were either going to argue every hour that God sent, or we were going to have a lot of fun together, because he completely understood what I was doing and how I was playing with the material, with the whole tradition of horror fiction, and wanted to really, I think he really respected the material, but he also wanted to make it his own thing, and I was very comfortable with him doing that.
He sounds like, you know, he sounds like his Miles Davis in the latter years. I think it's kind of cool.
That is cool.
Yeah.
No, they're all great, and they all have interesting things to say. A lot of the stuff we've been talking about comes out of that commentary for me.
Without a doubt, yeah.
You know, in terms of things that Virginia Madsen remembered, things that Bernard remembered, Clive definitely, you know what, this is the craziest thing, is I had forgotten about him being involved in this movie at all.
Clive?
Yeah, to begin
yes.
with. So when that came out, I was just like, oh my God, of course.
Yeah.
And that's why this makes so much sense. But then, yeah, to hear where he's coming from with it and talking about the adaptation and the changes, a lot of great stuff in that track. A lot of great
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, and one of the things, the sense that I got was that, first of all, he's very proud of this movie, too.
Yeah, rightfully
Clive
so.
Clive is. And I think the movie before this one for him was Nightbreed.
Oh, that's right.
Nightbreed's like it. I watched that recently, too. I did watch that before I watched this, because nice. I was waiting for this to come, and I was like, okay, I haven't watched Nightbreed in a while. Nightbreed, I watched like the super extended cut, and you know, it's funny, just what I do for a living, and just writing and stuff like that, you're always trying to fix story, you don't have a lot of time in TV. You're always just trying to go like, okay, what do I need? What are the elements I need to get this up and running and make sure this isn't boring, this doesn't suck, that everyone understands what this is about, and then I get to have fun, you know?
Yeah.
Especially with comedy. If I don't do all this... This movie was really interesting because you got Cronenberg acting in this movie, and he's playing a pretty important character, and he's not really an actor, but he is,
yeah.
you know? But he has really great moments inside of that thing, but the movie is crazy. It's out of its mind from the very beginning to the very end, where you're like, oh, this is ethereal.
Yeah. No, it's one of those quintessential Clive Barker things where yeah. you're like, this could only come from this guy.
Without
a
doubt.
Same thing with the Hellraiser, the Cenobites, yeah. all that. Those are his monsters, as he would say.
Yes, yes.
And he's unique in that way. And I think that's part of the reason this seems kind of tame in comparison. And
yeah, again, this is a lot of his stuff. I keep thinking of the word grounded. I feel like
yeah,
this is
grounded
for horror, and I think for horror to establish its own rules and how things aren't scary is really, really crucial to great horror. How the world is regular before you start introducing crazy, warped, fucked up things, you know?
Yeah.
And I think this movie really does it. And I think Clive Barker, coming off the heels of this movie, that it was a complicated movie, let's just say that,
yeah,
to producing a movie that really just made sense throughout the whole thing. And I think it seemed like he was really happy to be a producer.
Yeah, no, definitely. And it sounded like just the ultimate perfect collaboration between producer / mm-hmm. originator of material,
yeah.
who is encouraging of the director to make changes to make the best movie possible.
Yeah.
It's just one of those things, and I'm sure you know this more than anybody, how rarely that seems to happen where you have a true ally
yes.
in a producer.
Yes.
You know?
Yes. That's
there to make things better.
without a doubt. And I feel like those two guys were really had a great relationship throughout this.
Yeah. And again, the movie is a standing testament to that. I think one of the other things I forgot to mention that I love that comes out, I think, in the commentary or maybe in the interview, Tony Todd talked about how he and Virginia Madsen took ballroom dancing classes, and I think they took fencing classes.
Yeah.
Which I think is a really interesting, just in terms of the sort of the movement they have in some scenes and a general sense of that, I guess, seductive relationship.
Connecting physically, like even through dance, you know. That's why I thought this, that's where I was like, I haven't really, like I went in and I did a little bit of a dive with Bernard Rose in some of his other movies, just because I was going on a flight and I was like, I'm going to download his most recent available movie before this, which is a movie called Paper House.
I still have never seen Paper House. You're calling me out.
Yeah. So I watched it because I wanted to have one over you.
You won.
Yeah, I won. Good. I watched it, and it's a really interesting kind of dreamy tale where he gets a really fantastic performance out of a couple of kids, too. Like, really great. And I thought, if you can get those kinds of performances out of kids, imagine what this guy is, like, what his techniques are. And again, that's a technique worth ripping off of. Take these two leads to ballroom dancing or some or whatever class, or fencing, or something where you have to push and pull and give and take.
It's a totally different kind of thing. But something that could easily subconsciously help with performance that
I think
I would never think to ask them to do it. It's great.
I think that is a really, really cool idea.
But it all comes back to that idea of like a lot of brains working on how can we make this better? How can we make these relationships more intricate, more sophisticated? And it won't be things that you'll look at and go, oh, they clearly took ballroom dancing classes. No, but you can feel something else.
I think the camera picks it up. I think the camera picks up, and that's what it was. I was noticing the camera was smart enough to have a pacing that allowed for some acting to happen, for some scenes to kind of, you know, like to breathe and live. And again, you don't always see that in horror. I mean, the great horror you do when you treat it like drama and you really are establishing characters and letting people live in the moment and everything. So that was, again, that takeaway. I think the camera will pick all that stuff up.
Yeah, yeah, and it works. There's a few more featurettes from the original DVD. Sweets to the Sweet, The Candyman Mythos, and Clive Barker Raising Hell. Those are pretty straightforward kind of things. Then on the second disc, the unrated cut. Which cut did you watch, by the way?
So I went back and I watched the unrated cut.
Me too.
And I watched the first one, the original one first. I watched the first movie, then I started watching some commentaries and listening to commentaries and stuff. Yeah. And then I went to the second one recently, and I couldn't pick up. I was doing some other stuff in the meantime.
I know that.
I was doing my taxes.
Okay.
And I couldn't figure out exactly where what made the director's cut versus the original.
I can't. I feel like they touched on a few things.
It was unrated from what I understand. Yeah. It was something that they had that was pre, like, for the British rating boards or something like that. But they didn't really explain what it was, so I'm still a little perplexed of what the main differences were.
Well, the weird thing is that on the back, anyway, it says theatrical cut, 99 minutes, unrated cut, 99 minutes. So it could be one of those things where it's a matter of frames. It's a matter of gore.
It very well could be, because I did not see any difference in story, really. And then there were moments where I was like, wait a minute, am I so candy banned out that I'm imagining that I've never heard this before? Have I been seduced by Candyman?
Exactly.
I don't know.
I think you were hypnotized.
I think I may have been hypnotized at that point.
So this second disc has a bunch of new featurettes that they've done. There's one called Be My Victim, an interview with Tony Todd. There's It Was Always You, Helen, an interview with Virginia Madsen.
Yeah.
Writing on the Wall, the production design of Candyman. Forbidden Flesh, the makeup effects. And then Story to Tell, Clive Barker's The Forbidden. And then something called Urban Legend, Unwrapping Candyman. So there's, I feel like they cover a lot of sort of similar ground in some of these.
Some of them do. Now, there were a couple of people that I think show up on different commentaries. But a really interesting conversation I think needed to be happened were African Americans talking about this movie meant.
Yeah, that's the Urban Legend Unwrapping Candyman.
Okay, so that's what that was.
Well, I felt like it was, an African American couple where I think they're married. I couldn't tell.
They felt like they knew each other really well.
Yeah. So like one was like a professor and the other seemed to be also somewhat academic.
Yeah.
And they had a really interesting conversation just about.
Okay, so putting this in perspective, this movie came out on the heels of the L.A. riots after
the
O.J.'s, after the Rodney King trial. So So here we are in, you know, Riot, L.A., and then not too later afterwards, they were like, should we pull this movie? What is going on? Is this the bad? Is this the wrong? And then it did really well with the African-American audience. So I thought it was really interesting.
I thought they were both very fascinating.
And it's really, I think it's an important part of this, because it's right now talking about that stuff. I thought it was great.
Yeah.
The other thing I thought was really great was the, it wasn't unwrapping, so it was a story to tell, which was a guy who puts Clive Barker into perspective too, which I think is just a really interesting thing too, because who
is this
guy?
You know what? I didn't watch this one. Tell me about it.
So it's an author, and he's talking about the stuff that I was talking about earlier. Again, I don't think any of these thoughts are mine. These are just things I picked up from the Blu-ray.
There we go.
But he's talking about, imagine, you know, who was Clive Barker in the 80s, and what had he done? He was a filmmaker first. He had been making these little independent films, or just films with friends or whatever. And then he decided to get into the short story business, and he started doing these things. And then one day, this writer named Stephen King started saying, like, hey, this guy's kind of cool. And then all of a sudden, his sales just went through the roof, because everybody was dying to ingest new horror, and Stephen King vouched for him, you know? And so here's this guy who's this guy, he's young, and he's openly gay, I guess, maybe at the time, or he became,
not sure.
But he was an anomaly. There was nobody like him, and he was making these interesting, sexy, weird S&M-style horror movies, you know, with the Cenobites and leather and pins in their flesh and all kinds of stuff. So there was nobody like that, and he was writing these movies that were resonating in many different ways, just from great straight horror to, like, I need to rewatch this and try to figure out what all these metaphors are, you know? So, and then I still think he influences so many different people. I think he is an important part of horror culture, you know?
Absolutely. No, absolutely. And I haven't read enough of his stuff myself.
Yeah.
But it's clear whenever I hear him speak, whenever I see the films, that I'm like,
he's
this
got
is...
a thing. He's got a real personality.
Totally.
That really comes out.
Absolutely. No, and it's not just, and I'm not saying that horror, I mean, there is a lot of imitation and horror.
Mm-hmm.
It's just part of what it is.
I love it, though. I mean,
I do too.
They're...
I love slasher movies. I love things that I can know what to kind of know what to expect. But he's clearly just on another level.
Yeah,
and like this, I think that's a big reason for me that this movie stands out. But
yeah.
But anyway, yeah. It's,
and his personality comes through 100% in Candyman.
Yeah.
It's funny. I think about guitars, and I think it's really hard to have a personality on a guitar, like to play three notes and go like, oh, wait a minute, that's Brian May, or that's Eric Clapton, or that's somebody. And I think that's the same thing happens in horror. No matter what he does, his fingerprints all over it from a mile away, which is really cool. He's got a real voice.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess it comes through in sort of the gothic nature of things,
mm-hmm.
and the sort of...
the romantic, sexual,
romantic, yes,
the
exactly.
longing, the weird,
that's
kind of
it.
Woeful. I mean, again, so I think the two writers in one of the earlier commentaries, where is it? It's...
Kim Newman and Stephen Jones?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, they talk about it. They go, oh, look, so there he is. He's got the he's carrying Virginia Madsen at some point in the classics, just like Dracula and the Fainted Woman
totally.
Or Creature from the Black Lagoon or something.
Yeah.
There are all these tropes that kind of need to be echoed, but in a new way, you know? And who said this? Somebody said something about, like, you have to rip off constantly, but you have to add to that conversation. You have to, like, take it or twist it or do something new. And that's when we get excited about horror, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. No, but this is definitely a classic and a great release. Again, I don't know the differences between this and the Arrow disc, but I know that I'm not going to rush out and buy the Arrow because...
You got that one.
This is pretty great. I don't know how much more stuff I really need.
There's a lot of stuff here. I didn't think it was going to be this much stuff.
It's a ton. And I just love... I've said this before on this show. I just love that Scream Factory is, you know, as many years in as they are,
mm-hmm.
and they're still pulling out the classics, still giving them Cadillac treatment like this.
Yeah.
I was really impressed.
Yeah, I think it's a great one too.
Yeah, so thank you very much, sir, for coming on and talking about
Absolutely.
This.
Absolutely.
I appreciate it.
I really appreciate being here. I can't wait to have you talk me into buying stuff that I just saw anyway.
I will do that again at some point, I hope.
Yeah.
So briefly, I just want to plug... I used one of your tracks.
Oh, yeah, you
at
did,
the
yeah.
Interesting, at yeah. the beginning of the show, I used Ocean Galactic from your album Galacticon 2.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people know you from your shows, but I think that there may be some that don't know about your music, at least in my audience.
I've been lucky enough to, I went to music school, and then I got into stand-up, and I got into TV through all that stuff, and I've been lucky enough to be the guy who studied music, and so I can make music in my shows, and Death Clock and Metalocalypse, I got to really kind of start putting out records, and then I started thinking, like, I just like a little bit more, I like heavy metal a lot, and I was saying this to you earlier, I think heavy metal and horror do have some kind of
Definitely.
Parallels, where they're not always, they're kind of like, I don't know, the redheaded stepchild of the of the music or film world, where they don't get a ton of respect always, but there's a lot of technical ability that goes into making
a lot of craftsmanship.
Tons of craftsmanship. And in both genres, between horror and heavy metal, you get to say things in those genres that you don't get to say anywhere else.
Which,
so you can have like the heavy metal version of Cronenberg. You can have like the heavy metal version of really weird, just like people saying strange things about religion and conversations you cannot have and feelings you cannot have in any other kind of music. And that's the same thing about horror. So They're kind of parallel. They're two sides of the same coin for me. So I get to make these records where I tell these stories. So I have Galacticon 2 become the Storm, and I have Galacticon 1, which is a story in a comic book, a trade paperback that just came out. So if you go to galacticon.com, you can listen to this record and follow this kind of big, crazy redemption story of this, like almost like an independent Elaine May movie in outer space. That's how
I see it.
It's very influenced by like the original Heartbreak Kid and anti-heroes and things like that. So that's a project that I just, again, the trade paperback I did with, it's Albatross Comics. You may know the proprietor, Eric Powell, who is known for a comic called The Goon, amongst many others.
I do know that one.
And he has got a really cool cell phone publishing label house thing.
Nice.
Yeah. So you can check it out at galacticon.com or follow me on Twitter or Instagram, whatever.
Yeah,
the pictures of my dog.
I was checking out both albums, and I noticed. I know you're a huge Queen fan.
Oh, without you can hear it all.
I was gonna say for sure in Galacticon 1.
Yeah,
I'm hearing a lot of Flash Gordon.
I mean,
not to say that you're ripping anything off. I'm just saying
I can't believe that influence.
I
love Brian May, and I've loved him since I was in the movie theater watching Flash Gordon for the first time in 1980 with my aunt.
Totally,
there's a little Flash Gordon poster right up there in my studio.
Nice.
But of course, yeah.
And then Galacticon 2 is more, what are the influences of that?
That one's got like a little bit more. See, the thing is, I mean, I kind of have established this thing where I have to play heavy music, but I love all kinds of music. You were talking about Jeff Lynne a second ago, and I think about that when I make this heavy music. I think like, how can I make this melodic? And
I was going to say melodic. You're definitely, I've heard you in some interviews, you talk about melodic in terms of the guitar, melodic in terms of the voice.
Yeah.
Jeff Lynne is a totally melodic guy.
Yeah. And I think it's just melody is like, having a sense of melody is like having a sense of humor. Not everyone's got it. I really like melody. I think it's the most important thing. And, you know, I mean, just strong harmony and unique melody. So I spend a lot of time on that stuff, and that's important to me. And I think you can get people to lock in emotionally, even in this crazy, heavy stuff, you know?
Yeah.
And that's what I'm trying to do. That's what we're all trying to do, is emotionally manipulate one another.
That's right. That's right. Is podcasting,
if you're, if you're Candyman or a heavy metal guitarist, it's you're still trying to get people to do what you want or feel a certain way or feel different, have some kind of different emotional arc. You know,
take you out of whatever you're in.
That's a fun escape. Yeah.
But anyway, I just thought that was really cool, and thank you for letting me use your music on the show.
Absolutely.
Play us out with some of your music. But again, huge pleasure to have you on.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah,
I'm a big fan. So
very cool.
Yeah.
All right. Everybody have a wonderful and Blu-ray filled week, and we'll talk to you very soon. Bye-bye.